and left yourself in. Made good on a promise, never hurt again. If you're lost and loaded, you're broken down, bring all of your trouble, come lay on down.
Hey guys, and welcome to Kaisis, a podcast about living our new life in the new covenant age. Our podcast name comes from two Greek words, kaine ketesis, which mean new creation. I'm your co-host, Osvaldo Valdez, and let me welcome Pastor Todd Bordeaux.
Bring all of your trouble, come lay them down.
Welcome, everybody. It's good to have you back. And any new listeners, welcome also. I want to give two brief disclaimers at the beginning of this episode. The first one is this will be a little longer than usual. We've tried to keep them around 30, 35 minutes. We just have a bit more material, so of course it may go long. Of course, some of you play this on 1.5 times, so it may not be too long. Mm-hmm. And then also that this is an adult topic, not very wise to have children listening. I did check with Osvaldo. I asked, are you comfortable with this topic given your young age? And you're good, right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Pastor. Whenever I'm with my family, I always feel like I'm a child because I'm always with like my older aunts and everything. But it's only really at church that people start treating me a little bit like an adult. And sometimes I forget that I'm, you know, technically I'm an adult. So all this to say, yes, I'm comfortable and ready for this subject.
Well, that's good. And what were you saying a little bit about Hispanic culture dealing with these subjects?
You know, it's very unfortunate. In Latin American culture in general kind of keeps the subject of sex under wraps. You rarely talk about it at all. And if anything, if you grew up in a Christian household, it's pretty much the basic message of safe sex for marriage. And any other questions besides that is usually kind of like pushed under the rug or anything. So unfortunately, at least me growing up, I grew up with a very distorted view of sex because it was unaddressed, shy. My parents were very shy to talk about it sometimes. So honestly, I'm really glad we're able to kind of undertake this subject and hopefully bring clarity to it.
All right, so let's get into it. Remember last week, the first antithesis was on murder versus anger, that in the kingdom of heaven that Christ came to bring, that anger and insults are as murder, as Jesus said. Now, he doesn't mean it's the exact same thing, but the sin starts in the heart, and that is what the Lord sees. And so he used hyperbole, exaggeration, to show the importance of making things right with a brother you may have offended with an insult. And so in the old covenant, only murder was penalized. But now we're in the new covenant in the kingdom of heaven, and Jesus came to change hearts. And so it's not enough simply not to murder to stay in the kingdom, to be in the kingdom. But to truly be a member of the kingdom would result in a love for the brethren, a love that's so valued that we would even make right that which we've hurt. As much as we would worship God, we would value it as much. That's what the hyperbole of the temple symbolized. So now we're dealing with lust in the kingdom of heaven, and I'm going to ask Osvaldo to read our passage, Matthew 5, 27 through 30.
Yes, it reads, "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right arm causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell."
So notice the seriousness of this is the second time already that Jesus has spoken of hell. And being cut off in the old covenant from Israel was a picture of being cut off eternally in hell. And so that's what we're dealing with now that the pictures have disappeared. And so in the Old Testament, we have the same antithesis that there were penalties for adultery, but there were no penalties for lust. But now we're in the new covenant. Lust is adultery in the heart. It's the seed of adultery. But before God, we're just as guilty. And so God came to change our hearts, not just keep us from committing adultery. Now, when it says adultery in the heart is the same as the mind or the intent. It's the inward person. So it's important to remember here the androcentric principle of language that we've already spoken of earlier. And that is what's usually applied to both men and women are often spoken of as applying to men. It simply is too difficult to keep saying, and for the woman also, or for both, or him or her. And so when it says, anyone who looks at a woman lustfully, we would understand it that it's just as true for a woman. Mm-hmm. That if a woman looks at a man lustfully, she commits adultery in her heart. Now that's important because the Bible teaches that lust is not simply a man's problem more than a woman's problem. It's a human problem. But often it's presented in our day, well, man, lust is a man's problem. But the amount of women who watch pornography, according to all the surveys, would surprise people. But because we've said it so often that it's a man's problem, we've made it very difficult for women to come forward and get help who are struggling in this area, whether pornography or lust. And so we see in the Bible that it is simply a human problem. But the point of the antithesis is that the old heart that refrained from outward adultery, but still filled with lust, may have been enough to keep you inside Old Testament Israel in good standing, but it puts you outside of Christ's kingdom if you have a heart that's driven and filled with lust. In other words, the point is Jesus came in his kingdom to bring a new heart.
Yes.
He came to bring the kingdom of heaven. And so if imagine that we're all in heaven, and we did this last week with insults. Now imagine we're all standing before the Lord in heaven. We're all praising his name. We see the angels. And somebody looks at someone else with lustful thoughts, lustful looks. If you cannot imagine that, which hopefully you cannot, that shows you that lustful thoughts and looks don't belong in the kingdom of heaven. And so that's the point of the antithesis. Any thought on just a general summary before we get into the details?
Yeah, it's something I want us to kind of know is that, especially here in the United States, we have a tendency to kind of elevate subjects regarding, you know, sexuality, especially sins regarding the subject of sexuality. We used to elevate them more or consider them more sinful or more intense. But something that Jesus interestingly does, I mean, he has them on the same level as, like, you know what? Anger and hate is an equal issue as, you know, lust for a woman. So I'm not trying to minimize what like, you know, the issue of lust. But what I really want us to do is kind of like understand that Jesus here is holding him at the same level because his kingdom is so different that requires such a holistic transformation that all these things are equally of value. Then we need to address these each seriously, anger as well as lust and the other subjects that he brings later.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, notice how the text says, he who looks at a woman or man, of course, lustfully, is committing adultery with her in your heart. And we have to distinguish, and conservative Christians have a really hard time with this, distinguishing noticing beauty and lusting. Lusting is committing adultery with a person in your heart. That's what you're thinking about, the sexual act. And some Christians are so afraid to notice beauty that they get all twisted in trying to ignore beauty or run from it. But noticing beauty is not the same thing as imagining having relations with that person.
Yeah.
Now, this distinction is so important because the Bible recognizes beauty, our beauty, mm-hmm. because God created beauty. So, for example, 1 Samuel 9:2, Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel. This is the inspired writer's viewpoint of Saul's appearance. That when you saw him, he was a very handsome man. And then you have Genesis 29:17, speaking of Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful. And so God created beauty. Recognizing beauty is not sinful. So many Christians live with this false guilt. Well, I can't go out where people look, you know, pretty, or I can't ever go to the beach, or this or that. There's nothing wrong with noticing people who have nice forms and pretty faces or handsome faces. The Bible does that. Yeah. Don't be holier than God. Hmm. You know, when Cheryl and I are watching television, I'll ask her, I'll say, "Is that guy handsome?" Because I don't really know, you know, and then she'll say, "Do you think she's pretty?" It doesn't threaten our relationship to simply notice that. It's not lusting.
No.
And if you don't make that distinction, you have Christians who have a fear of people, a fear of looking at people and thinking, "Oh, I must have sinned because I've noticed." And that's an awful thing. Any comment on that distinction?
You know, being in a youth group during high school was actually very hard. You know, the high school experience altogether was very hard. You know, hormones are raging and you like girls and everything. And then you get like a weird mixed message in youth group. And one of those things was like, you know, sometimes unintentionally, the youth leaders were trying to be malicious or anything. But, you know, sometimes not lusting was synonymous with, you know, not noticing beauty. And kind of the logic was, you know, we're supposed to find kind of the root of our sin, you know, where like lust always starts with what? Seeing, right? Or something like that, right? And then they would take that to its logical end by saying, you have to be careful who you see. Noticing beauty can lead to this, lead to that, and then ultimately lead to, I don't know, lust. And that, you know, like you said, that's actually very harmful because that goes beyond what the passage is actually saying. And another mixed message can be like, emphasizing, you know, inward beauty, not to say that that's like not a good thing, but when you emphasize inward beauty so much, it sends the wrong message about outer beauty, you know, as a physical appearance, it's not important or even like wrong. And it becomes so unfortunate because, you know, especially at least growing up, you have all these like mixed messages coming from the church, coming from home, that even personally, I found it easier to talk about girls with my non-believer friends than it was actually with other Christians. And it has to do with just kind of this misconception, like you said, of like noticing beauty versus, you know, actually desiring to do something with such and such person.
Yeah, and so we saw last week that once we understand that hatred and insults does not fit in Christ's kingdom, now we hear that it's not just adultery, but lust does not belong in Christ's kingdom. Christ gives a remedy like he did for anger, in what his members will do, how they will deal with it. And it says, if your right eye and your right hand cause you to stumble, cut them off. Now, you have to imagine that the disciples listening to this at the time had no idea what he was talking about.
Yeah.
But in the Bible, the right eye often denotes knowing evil and the right hand doing evil. And so often you think of Revelation 13:16. It also forced all the people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands or on their foreheads. Again, the idea of foreheads or eyes, seeing evil and then doing evil. And so it's symbolic for both. The point is that in Christ's kingdom, God's people will not be so filled with lust that they'll live that way. That God's people will hate inward lust as much as adultery, and they would rather suffer than live in that lust. So to cut your right eye off, cut your hand off is symbolic of suffering, of difficulty. Now, obviously, this is hyperbole. I think you started with a story last week that there were someone, one or two from church history, who actually took this literally, right?
Yeah, it wasn't actually this particular passage in general, but actually had to do with Matthew 19:12, where it says, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. So the famous, what tradition tells us is like individuals like Origen, a church figure and theologian slash heretic and sometimes Orthodox. Anyways, for the sake of the kingdom, I mean, he went to the length of actually castrating himself, saying that passage, you know, it's for the sake of the kingdom that he is doing that. So, I mean, Jesus wasn't encouraging self-mutilation, but people took that very seriously.
Right, and we've already seen hyperbole used before, and it will keep coming back. So that's really important to understand. Yeah. But I think everyone at this point at least says, oh, yeah, this is hyperbole. Sometimes they fail to extend that principle to the others, which we'll get to in the coming weeks. But,
oh, yeah.
And so the point is that God's people will care about inward lust, and then they'll deal with it. They won't be satisfied simply that they don't commit adultery. And so if cutting off the eye means not living in lust, how do we do that? What's the remedy? Well, there's two ways to deal with lust. One is the way of the Pharisees, and the other is the way of the new covenant, the way of Christianity. The Pharisees figured that since the mind, especially in their minds, the male mind, is full of lust, the way you deal with lust is simply to avoid looking at whatever might tempt you. And so we read in the Talmud that there were seven types of Pharisees. One of them, one group, was known as the bleeding Pharisees. And in other sections, it says the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. The reason they were called the bleeding Pharisees is they covered their eyes whenever a young woman approached when they were walking down the street. And because they were covering their eyes, they often walked into walls. And therefore, they were bleeding. And they were called the bleeding Pharisees.
No.
Now, that's a comical picture, but it sort of summarizes the way non-Christians approach this topic. The focus is not on a new heart, but on changing your outward circumstances to keep things away from you that might tempt you to lust.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with this legalistic view is that Christ came to give us a new mind and a new heart.
Yeah.
So lust would not flow out of us, and it wouldn't matter what we're looking at or who we're looking at, because he came to fill our hearts with something better than lust. We think of 1 Timothy 1:5, but the goal of our instruction is love from a pure heart. The goal of our teaching is that people would have a pure heart from our teaching.
Yeah.
Not learn all the tricks to avoid other people, you know, things that non-Christians can easily do. And so the opposite of lust, what Christ came to bring, is love. And that is what a pure heart towards others is love. When you love someone, you're not lusting after them.
Yeah.
When you love someone, you care about them. You're not using them for your self-gratification. Why is it Jesus never lusted? He never lusted because he loved perfectly, not because he perfectly avoided women. He wasn't the perfect legalist. He had perfect love. And so he only looked upon people with a pure heart that never used them for his own appetite. He always loved them purely. That's the goal. That's the purpose that Christ came to bring us, that pure heart. So those two ways are very different. Any thought before we get more into that on the two ways?
Yes, and you know that this idea of the two ways is best reflected in the experience of Israel, especially their experience after their exile. Right now, I'm prepping for a sermon, and without giving too much away, you know, it's very interesting that you know, after some of the Jewish people, you know, being in exile in Persia and Babylon, they're finally returning to Israel, and you see there's these genuine efforts to have external social and religious reform. You know, let's change our behavior, let's change how we do things, let's try to do a 180, you know, a transformation. And they would read passages like Jeremiah or Ezekiel that kind of has kingdom language. But unfortunately, they would really kind of they would like overlook passages to talk about, like in Ezekiel, the issue is not just about God's kingdom come, but it's about having a new heart. Or Jeremiah, it's not just about reinstituting the old covenant. It's about a new covenant. And unfortunately, the experience of a lot of these, of Israel, especially post-exile, is just frustration. No matter how much social and religious reform they exercise, it always ends in returning back to their old former ways. And I think that's exactly what's happening here in Jesus. Jesus is bringing us a solution that post-exile Israel could never get, which was namely a new heart, a different heart that he's bringing forth with his kingdom. And that this is like, especially this is like one of those moments that make Jesus' kingdom so different from the old.
Yeah, and when you look at the early church, there is no way they could escape outward sexual images, because if you know anything about the Greek world was extremely pornographic.
Yeah.
There were brothels everywhere, prostitutes in the street. Sometimes the rooms where prostitutes plied their trade were open with windows. There were statues of naked people, of sexual acts, drawings all over. The most popular statue or drawing was a phallus, male genitalia. In Alexandria in 275 BC, a 180-foot-long gold-plated phallus was paraded through the streets of the city. Yeah. It was flanked by elephants, a rhino, a giraffe, decorated. People were expected to be there. It's interesting, you know, Pompeii, the volcano overran Pompeii, and it needed to be completely excavated. When they did, they found so many erotic and pornographic images all through the town that King Francis of Naples visited in 1819, and he had his young daughter with him. And after giving the tour, he ordered a censorship of all the city's sexual statues and life. And so everything was taken away, and it wasn't until the 20th century that they were shown to the public again. Even public bathrooms, you know, you went to the bathroom out in the open in the Roman world, and the higher up, the more that was a sign of nobility. And so the answer in the Bible is not to leave the city. Take your families and your children out to the country and farm and try to survive, because there's too much to look at that can tempt you. Paul doesn't go that route. He doesn't tell them to leave the city. He speaks about a new heart that does not have to live in lust. So it's not about the outward circumstances. It's about the heart. Any thoughts on life for a Christian in the first century world?
You know, it's interesting. There was a Roman historian called Suetonius, and he wrote a book called The Lives of the Caesars. And he gives a very kind of detailed account about Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and Nero. And he describes, you know, their whole life, including their sex life. And we're talking about very, like, you know, rampant adultery, you know, indulging in orgies, affairs with young boys and other married women. And it's interesting because the only thing out of that list, the only thing that's kind of looked down upon is just the affairs with young boys. But other than that, you know, Suetonius just kind of like describes it as it's just a matter of fact. So you can imagine like living as a Christian in the city of Corinth, right? A port city where you can imagine like prostitution everywhere in the streets, simple prostitution, kind of. How not only how shocking, but also how countercultural, you know, it means to. it sounds so like obvious, but simply not to engage with prostitutes was considered very, very countercultural. And Paul, you know, was how to address that issue, because a lot of Christians were struggling with exactly that. How to be countercultural in a world where this is just the norm.
Yeah, it's interesting that the Greeks also tried to deal with lust, because lust was so rampant. And the way the Greeks dealt with lust was to make sure that the respectable Greek women that shouldn't be lusted after remained hidden. And so the more respectable you were to be, the more you were hidden from the rest of society. You were kept in the house. You were fully covered when you went out. So they didn't mind the prostitutes being lusted after. But if they didn't want respectable women being lusted after, they hid them. Matter of fact, in the Hellenistic period, dress, women's dress was actually regulated by men. They had a political position called the controllers of women. And they were elected officials that made sure women looked modest. And then it's Augustus who ruled that women can no longer wear togas, only stolas. Because they started wearing togas, and he wanted to distinguish men from women. And women walking outdoors needed to be covered with veils over their faces. Hmm. Now, the Greek writer Plutarch, in one of his essays, was saying that men will do whatever they can to get a peek at women. So it's up to the ladies to shoulder the brunt of their male actions and to hide from them. And so Plutarch wrote, "We cannot forbear prying into sedans and coaches or gazing at the windows or peeping under the balconies where women are." Hmm. So it's the Greek idea that we can't help yourselves, so you need to keep your beauty from us. Hide yourself so we don't see you. And again, that's the non-Christian way to deal with it. The Muslims do the same thing, don't they? Mm-hmm. They want their women covered from head to toe. And yet, of course, lust and rape is rampant among Muslims. And then even in America, up to the early 1900s, ankles were considered a turn-on for men. And so women were encouraged to cover their ankles. And the church has so often adopted this Pharisaical way of dealing with lust. Even Tertullian back in the second century wrote, "Let a holy woman, if naturally beautiful, give no one such occasion for carnal lust. Certainly, if she is beautiful, she should not show off her beauty, but she should rather obscure it." So again, if you're beautiful, nobody should see that you're beautiful. Hide it. And how often young women today in the church are told, "You need to cover up or men will lust after you." And that idea originated among the pagans. It's saying that I will lust, I can't control it, so it's your job to make sure I don't see anything that causes me to lust. That is not the way Christ approaches it at all, but often it's the way the church does.
Yeah.
Any thought as you've read church history on this?
You know, there's obviously mixed messages in church history, but probably one of the earliest writings that we have are the letters of Ignatius. And it's interesting because men are usually addressed primarily more than women. And we've mentioned this before. The reason being is because men had more social freedom to engage in society than some women. So whenever he addresses young women, it's often very brief, and it's the same message of, you know, maintain purity and live righteously. But it's interesting because Ignatius addresses young men actually a lot. You know, he addresses paragraphs upon paragraphs, calling young men to show restraint, to live a life of purity and righteousness. But it's interesting, like we've been talking about, Ignatius doesn't make it the woman's fault, or at least that's not what his letters communicate. Or rather, communicate that as Christians, you know, there has to be an initiative from the young man's point of view, from his standpoint, from his position. He has to exercise restraint. He has to exercise purity. He has to exercise respect for his fellow neighbor. So even early on, we do have at least the beginnings of this self-awareness that, maybe it's not women, you know, it's the individual that needs to be worked on and transformed.
Hmm. That's interesting. So from a Christian perspective, let the world come up with all their rules and codes, because that's how they deal with these things. And we'll talk about how we do fit into that as Christians. We're in the world, but for Christians in the kingdom of heaven, it's all about a new mind and a new heart. Romans 13:13-14. Let us behave decently as in the daytime, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousy. Rather, clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ, and do not think about how to gratify the desires of the flesh. And so the antidote to gratifying the desires of the flesh is not legalism, but to clothe ourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ, to have the mind of Christ, to have the love of Christ for others, that when we see them, we're not objectifying them, but we're caring for them. And so with the mind of Christ, we don't use others for our benefit, but we love them. When I help people addicted to pornography, if they're Christians, then the problem, of course, is of the heart. And I try to show them you're using people. You need to see the people you've been looking at as human beings.
Yeah.
Many of them have been subject and continue to be subject of abuse, or they're abusing themselves by degrading themselves and becoming less than human. You need to see them with the mind of Christ. And so you're offended at yourself for using them. It's not about seeing them as temptresses. And so the answer is simply to avoid people. Now, there may be an immediate need, yes, to get your computer out and all that stuff, but the way this is going to change is that you don't support and approve of the degradation of human beings.
Yeah.
But you see them with the mind of Christ. So begin to pray that God will give you more and more the mind of Christ. And let's learn to see these people as humans. And that as you wouldn't want that done to your brother, sister, daughter, then you wouldn't want that done to anyone being used that way.
Yeah.
So it's about the mind changing and seeing people as humans. I'll give you a kind of a comical example that's not sinful in that sense. But when Cheryl and I were newly married, we were invited to a couple's house who wanted to ask me questions about, well, actually, we hadn't been newly married. We were starting in seminary. But anyway, this was in Escondido. We were invited to a couple's house who wanted to ask us about a theological question. And they invited some other guests over, and they put out a huge display of food. It was beautiful. You know, it was lamb.
Yeah.
All these great side dishes. Yeah, they went all out.
Yeah.
So we're sitting there with them and two other couples, but one of the guys they invited did not have any arms. And so he had taught himself to eat with his toes, with his feet. And so he would put his feet up on the table and eat with his toes. Well, Cheryl had a very queasy stomach over things like this. And, you know, she admitted she had a hard time watching people with disabilities that were that, you know, obvious. And so it was hard for her to eat the meal. I mean, no problem for me, because you put that kind of food in front of me. You know, I don't care if Jabba the Hutt is eating next to me. I'm going to enjoy it. But no, it didn't bother. But as we talked about it, you know, we talked like this. I said, maybe, you know, seeing them, just look in their eyes, seeing them as people and what they've been through. And what the point is that as Cheryl grew in her faith over the years, that didn't bother her anymore.
Yeah.
When she sees someone with, you know, that obvious of a disability, she sees them and it just doesn't bother. Well, what changed? She didn't learn to avoid them because she had this. She grew in her faith and in her love for people. Now it wouldn't be a problem eating dinner. So the same thing is the point with lust. We grow as we grow in the love of Christ for others. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you make the good point that, especially when it comes to issues like pornography, you know, it's not just about treating, you know, symptoms like, you know, like exactly that, like watching pornography or whatnot. But also addressing like the underlying issue, right? A more fundamental issue, which is your heart, how you see your fellow neighbors, right? It's like these individuals, these porn stars, I mean, they're actually made in God's image in such a way that they're also in need of the gospel. They're also equally valuable to God. And it's interesting because, I mean, a good example would be like, for example, like Alcoholic Anonymous or these social programs that some of them are Christian or secular. They're excellent, right, in treating these the kind of the external issues that some of these things have whenever it comes to like abuse of alcohol or abuse of or pornography use. There's, you know, there are both Christian and non-Christian programs that address, you know, the issue of pornography or alcohol. Right. But even if you address those issues, there's still some underlying issue at hand. And Jesus aims not just merely the outside issue, because he cares, obviously, about how we act externally, that we don't act in adultery, that we don't act in fornication or whatnot. But he also cares, at a more fundamental level, how we see and esteem our fellow neighbor. And you just said it excellently, like you can not watch porn and still esteem women as mere objects of pleasure, you know? So it's not, I'm not saying that these programs that help you not watch porn, help you stop that. I'm not saying those are not good, but what Jesus brings is more than just a mere social reform. He's bringing a whole transformation of body and soul, where we not only change our external engagement with our neighbor, but we also change internally how we see our neighbor in such a way that we love them and express that outwardly.
Yeah, I think Dave Harvey, if I remember right, in one of his books, talks about almost every case of a pastor who ends up committing adultery with someone in his church. When they look back at his ministry, he's basically, excuse my language, but you'll understand why I say this, he's basically been screwing people for years. Hmm. So in other words, he's been using people in different ways as object for his own benefit, maybe for his own pride and vanity. And so it was just the next step to use them sexually. Wow. But the problem was still, as you said, using people instead of loving them. And so our goal is not simply to avoid one outward sin, but to have the mind of Christ, as you said, and loving people. Now, that usually raises the objection, what about the calls to modesty in the Bible? Does that mean we can dress any way we want? Well, let's look at that for a little bit. In the context of 1 Timothy 2, the call to modesty is on women dressing to show off their wealth.
Yeah.
And so the principle there is not to show off in the way we dress, but that not only includes dress, but the way we speak,
yes,
the way we write. And so whenever modesty is addressed in the Bible, first of all, it's always addressed to that individual to voluntarily believe these things and respond. It's never, husband, cover up your wives. It's never, you know, pastors, give rules on what people can wear. It's always addressed to that individual Christian to think about these things. And it's always a matter of intent. Why are you doing it? The why is always addressed. It's not a do not wear list. And so the point is, modesty means we do not dress, act, or speak in a way that would try to cause lust or envy to get attention. So it really comes down to a matter of the heart. We don't always know why people dress. It could be their background, that's the culture. They're thinking something different. We're not to rush to judgment over how people dress, but why we do things is what matters. Are we trying to lure people into sin? Are we trying to cause envy? You know, you may, a woman may bring a very expensive purse to church, but she maybe hasn't even given it a second thought. Her husband bought it for her birthday. That's her only purse. She's not trying to cause other women to envy her. Or it may be the opposite. She can't wait to show off how wealthy she is. So it's the matter of the heart in dress, whether modesty is about sexual lust or wealth or anything. But that also includes, you can go the opposite and dress too dowdy to show off your spirituality. And so, you know, look how spiritual I am. I wear a head covering. Or, you know, I cover my arms and I never wear pants or whatever. That's immodest going that way too, because you're still dressing to show off. Any thoughts or examples on that?
Yeah, so it's interesting, Pastor, because one of the big, I guess, culture slash religious clash that my wife Megan had with my family was actually over clothing, and there was actually a little bit of a clash there that actually put a little bit of a strain in her relationship with my family. And it's because, you know, for some of my family, you know, certain clothes were more Christian than others, and if you didn't dress a particular way, then that was a reflection of your own spirituality. And, you know, and they would draw from exactly these passages where these passages have, they don't have anything to do necessarily with external things as much as they have to do with internal things. Are you trying to communicate wealth? Are you trying to communicate unchristian things? Or are you just simply trying to wear something comfortable, right? Those are very two. That's what Paul is addressing. What is your intention? What are you trying to communicate with this form of dress? And like you said, it's interesting. He leaves it to the individual, kind of, hey, be mindful of what you communicate with what you dress. And it's very unfortunate because I think a lot of fundamentalist conservative Christian culture takes this move beyond mere intention to more like, you know what, the way you regulate lust, whatnot, is by external means, and it's always aimed towards the woman as her responsibility as to what to dress or what not to dress. And it's very unfortunate, you know, because it starts affecting relationships, starts affecting church interactions, because it moves, like, your immediate reaction in the way you dress is to assume the worst. Unfortunately, no, you're just trying to provoke your fellow brother. Well, what happened if that's not the case? Maybe the issue isn't her. Maybe it's you, you know. And that's kind of where a lot of people find themselves.
Yeah, we had a guy in one of my previous churches. He was a real piece of work, but he wrote me a letter complaining about some of the young women in the church who dress like, and you know the word with it starts with a W. I don't want to use that word. And so I wrote him back. And I said, maybe you could learn to care for people and find out about them. How do you know these young people hadn't been abused? How do you know they don't have one parent in the home and they don't haven't been taught fashion? How do we know that their hearts may be much closer to the Lord than yours? He was not happy with that and left the church, which I was thankful for.
Yeah, man.
But... yeah, it's always the women. The men never have to think about these things, do they?
No, it's very hypocritical.
It is. So there is another aspect of modesty that most conservative Christians don't think about, and that is that we do not shock unbelievers. And so we care about expectations of the world, and we do want to fit in that sense. So we don't want to go too far one way or the other. If we're so dowdy and conservative that we stand out in the wrong way, Paul is very concerned that we fit in, that we don't shock them, that if we're going to offend them, it's in our message, not in outward things like that. And so fitting in is actually good. It's good to be fashionable. But you can shock them the other way. I mean, if the world thinks you're dressing too wrong, you know, then we should consider that. So we don't use our freedoms to flaunt them in front of the world. We care about what non-Christians think. And I'm going to quote the epistle to Diognetus. This is AD 130, as he describes what Christians were like back then. For the Christians are distinguished from other men, neither by country, nor language, nor the customs which they observe. For they neither inhabit cities of their own, nor employ a particular form of speech, nor lead a life which is marked out by any singularity, but inhabiting Greek as well as barbarian cities, according as the lot of each of them has determined, and following the customs of the natives in respect to clothing, food, and the rest of their ordinary conduct, they display to us their wonderful and confessedly striking method of life. And so when they looked at the Christians, they dressed just like everyone else.
Yes.
And that was a positive. Any thought on this epistle to Diognetus?
Yes, and I think the epistle to Diognetus gives us a lot of insight as to how Christians originally engaged with culture. And like you mentioned before, it wasn't it what their answer to culture wasn't to be like an ancient form of Amish, right? Like just separating themselves from society altogether. Like Diognetus describes, I mean, like the epistle, I mean, to Diognetus describes, I mean, Christians were looked like people within their own cultures. And it's very interesting because in books like the epistle to the Galatians, Paul is actually very concerned about the Gentiles conforming to Jewish to Jewish customs and way of living. And he argues from the standpoint on the basis of Abraham's covenant. I mean, God has called the nations to be part of his peoples, but in order for the nations to be called, they must remain as nations. You know, they must be this like distinctly Gentile, because that brings God glory. And it's interesting, Pastor, because it wasn't really until the monastic, you know, an ascetic period of Christianity, where you see a lot, like hundreds of years after, you know, the original ministry of the apostles, that you see Christians kind of separating themselves from society altogether as the solution. And that unfortunately brings harm. And I guess a modern expression of this monastic ascetic practices, where this idea of separating from yourself from society was expressed by the Mennonites, or as we know them as, you know, the Amish, or some radical form of Puritanism, where they practice some really extreme forms of trying to separate themselves from society because that was the solution. And that simply isn't the case. You know, that simply wasn't the experience of the early Christians.
Yeah, and the early Christians reached millions of people, didn't they?
Yeah, and it's very interesting how that, and it, like they didn't have evangelism ministries or anything like that. It was very organic, you know. Merchants remained merchants, just the difference that they were Christian merchants, and they brought the gospel to their respective business places. And the carpenter was now a Christian carpenter and brought, once again, right, the gospel to his own context. And it was very, it's just fascinating to see how the gospel organically grew from Christians being Christians within their own context.
Yeah. And so let's begin to summarize. Purity culture, probably the worst part of purity culture, is it assumes what the Greeks assumed, that men are going to lust, and women then are also just as responsible to keep men from lusting by covering up. And so women are treated as objects of temptation, and men are assumed to be lustful creatures. But we see here in Matthew 5 that it's your responsibility. It's not the amount of epidermis shown by other people that causes you to lust. Lust always starts in the heart, James chapter 1. It's always a desire you have, and the answer is not outward changes, but love. Mm-hmm. With the mind of Christ, to see other people as image bearers and not want them debased, but want what's best for them.
Yeah.
And so because lust is a spiritual problem, it requires a spiritual solution. Now, if you're watching television and you start to lust, sure, turn it off. But even then, the problem is not the show. The problem is you. It's always you. Other people cannot make you lust. So to cut out your eye, so to speak, is to confess your own sin and responsibility, and then to pray for Christ's likeness and to grow in Christ's love for you and for others. That means that the church should always be a place of safety. Now, I know there's always wheat that are in with the tares, so there'll be people who aren't really Christians that in every church, but in general, the church should be a place of safety, that there are people there with new minds, the mind of Christ, that no matter what new people come dressed in, and they may be unbelievers, that's a place they're not going to be lusted after or ogled, but they will be cared for as human beings. Mm-hmm. The church should be the safest place. That's where these people learn how God values them. And then they can learn to value themselves and others that way as they know Christ and they receive his love. And so Love instead of lust is the ethic of the kingdom of heaven that Christ came to bring. Any final thought?
Yeah, I want to note that it's interesting to see how even before Jesus' ministry, there were some Jewish and Greek philosophers that tried to address the issue of lust by discouraging impulsive behavior and imposing, you know, rigorous and disciplined behavior as a solution. But Christ is so radical in saying, no, the only way this is addressed at all is in my person and the spirit that he gives. And that's exactly the difference between the Christian message and any other message, that the solution to humanity's right problem or at all is not just not how much effort you're willing to put in to address this. No, it's that you there's no effort you can give. You need to be transformed by Christ, his kingdom, and his spirit in you. And that's the source of both our comfort and our strength to combat sin. And I think that's what makes us completely different from any message out there. Christ in the spirit.
Yeah, and I wanted to add one thing. Thank you for that. Just so people don't misunderstand. When I told that man, you know, maybe that girl's been abused, or maybe it also could be she's just being fashionable and the guy is just old-fashioned and legalistic. And so often what we think is, oh, that women shouldn't wear that. They're just fitting in.
Yeah.
They're just being fashionable. They're not trying to tempt people. That's not their goal. And so we often use our own cultural reference, and then we use that to judge everyone else, which is wrong. But so hopefully this has been helpful, opening up that passage. Next week, we're going to talk about divorce, which I think most of our listeners know is what I've written on my dissertation on this particular passage. So it won't get any easier as we move on, but thanks for your help and your openness in sharing these things, those Paul. Oh, you rich man, and high above all of the wind and wind I love, all you burn. Broken down, all of your trouble, come lay them down, come lay them down, come lay them down.